Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halker.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Coming up on this week's show, Michel Gondry's The Science of Sleep, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, and music from The Arcade Fire.
Plus, this week's top five. If I could be one character in the history of film, I would be. Film Spotting plays pretend, yes. But first, it's a brand new set of Mean Streets for Martin Scorsese in The Departed.
This is not the regular police! This is the state police!
We are an elite unit.
This is who we're after.
Frank Costello.
You won't be paid as a regular cop, but there's a bonus involved.
So what do I do?
You will not ever know the identity of undercover people.
You have anyone in with Costello presently?
Maybe.
Do you know who I am?
Maybe not.
If you've seen even one Martin Scorsese movie, it should take you about 60 seconds to recognize The Departed as a Martin Scorsese film. Jack Nicholson's nostalgic voiceover narration, the slow-motion opening tracking shot, followed by a point-of-view steadicam shot of Nicholson's Irish gangster walking into a South Boston neighborhood shop. If it all sounds very Goodfellas, it should. The familiar late 60s song you're hearing? That's Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones, which you'll also find on the Goodfellas soundtrack. The Departed is a remake of the 2002 Hong Kong crime drama Infernal Affairs, and as you would probably expect from Scorsese, he and screenwriter William Monahan have done more than just transplant the original's milieu. They've also turned a fairly taut cat-and-mouse story into a sprawling psychological drama. In Infernal Affairs, the suspense is intense but simple. Who will get discovered first, the cop pretending to be a criminal or the criminal pretending to be a cop? In The Departed, the question isn't so much who will get caught, the undercover cop, Billy Costigan, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, or the undercover criminal, Colin Sullivan, played by Matt Damon, as it is who will be the first to self-destruct under the increasing duress of their personal demons. Sam, we're both big fans of Infernal Affairs. Is Scorsese's treatment more effective, less effective, or is it perhaps like a great cover song that is different in its instrumentation and tone, but equally as enjoyable?
I wonder if you're unconsciously asking me about the cover version of Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb.
That's what I'm doing.
By Van Morrison.
Because I know you love it.
That, of course, played prominently in the trailer. And I think that's an apt comparison. It's a cover song. And I think, at the very least, a cover song has to remind you what's good about the original, just as I would claim Van Morrison's cover song does, cover version does. That being said, I still will take the original Infernal Affairs over The Departed. And but first, let me just say, I think what he and screenwriter Monahan do is they retain, like I said, they remind you what's so good about the original, and the original is the story. The built-in suspense and drama, like you said, you've got the undercover cop with the gangsters, the undercover gangster with the cops. That's a great story.
It is.
Right there. I mean, that's a nutshell. How do you not walk in to a producer's office in Hollywood and give that quick description and not sell it?
It's a great plot, and it's also loaded with all these identity questions.
Right. And they don't screw it up. It's still really, really compelling. Uh-huh. And I think the acting's really good. I really like DiCaprio, and I like Damon. I know a lot have been said about the fact that these guys are young and, can they pull off the weight of it? And I really like Damon's as loose as I've ever seen him. He's really fun to watch, particularly early. DiCaprio's great. The rest of the cast, Alec Baldwin playing this sort of mollified version of his Glengarry character, is great. Martin Sheen is great. Please notice the conspicuous absence of any mention of Jack Nicholson. We'll get to that.
We'll get to him.
My problem with it, you brought up this whole idea, the psychological nuance, the layers they've added to it. I don't think it adds up to much. I don't think it helps the story, to be honest. And I think in some cases it's a distraction. And in some cases, because it's not just the psychological detail, you can sense that Monahan has tried to give some sense of Boston crime. You know, like you said, Nicholson's opening narration, he's like, 20 years after an Irishman couldn't get a job, we were president of the United States. I feel like a lot may have been cut out. I wonder if Monahan did a lot of research, and this whole idea of the Southie versus the North Shore, where we this identity crisis of DiCaprio's and the nature of the Irish mafia.
Uh-huh.
In the film, it's like the Irish mafia is like six guys.
Right.
And I have to admit, like, I didn't get any sense that this was part of a larger operation. I mean, there's a lot. Like you said, you spend the first 20 minutes just getting to know, you know, this DiCaprio's motivation, say.
Right.
And we learn a lot about his upbringing. There's no payoff. And it doesn't, for me, give me any information about why he does what he does. Why does he stay undercover? Why does he even join the police department? There's a lot about the test he goes through before he goes undercover. But ultimately, why he stays undercover or why he remains a cop is a big question. And Damon, where's his loyalty to Costello? Mm-hmm. I don't understand primarily. And again, we'll get to this. When Nicholson's character is a lowlife.
Yeah.
He's a lowlife. He's offensive. He's not the kind of character that you feel like you would have any sympathy for or has even charisma necessarily.
Right.
And of course, I know I'm saying a character played by Nicholson doesn't have charisma, yeah. But I don't know. Those are my problems with it ultimately.
No, I have problems with it as well. And I do agree with you about the, well, what I'll say I disagree with you on is I do think there is payoff to DiCaprio's character, but I definitely agree with you that Nicholson's character here, we'll get into it more, but with Damon, I didn't feel really the affection, the affiliation, the reason why he is willing to sacrifice everything that he's worked for and be the person he is, mm-hmm. even though I think Scorsese has a reason for it. We'll talk about whether or not it's effective. I agree that I didn't feel like you feel in Infernal Affairs. You actually do understand with less material, you actually understand more why he has that affection and is willing to infiltrate the police and be this guy's undercover guy in the agency. I actually do feel like the movie gets that better. But this movie, I have to say, despite some of its flaws, the first hour of this film is the best film I've seen this year, without a doubt for me.
Wow.
Without a doubt. I have not been that giddy in my seat, and fine, if I'm just a Scorsese guy, fine, maybe that's it. But I literally have not been that excited watching a film as I was that first hour, watching the great Michael Ballhaus camera work, the editing by Thelma Schoonmaker, his regular cinematographer, his regular editor. They're great. And I give the credit to Monahan, I really do, for the first hour of this film. It's basically 60 minutes of testosterone-fueled ball busting.
Yeah, it is.
And it actually reminded me a lot of Mamet, though with a completely different rhythm. It has a rhythm, though, just like Mamet does. There's a patter to it. There is a tempo to it. And it does exactly what Mamet does so well, which is simultaneously celebrate the masculine ideal and mock it. And I think that's really great. I have to say, the first hour, I laughed a lot.
Yeah,
And I was just excited listening to the characters talk to each other as I was watching the movie, which with a Scorsese film, that's pretty impressive. Even when it's not two men talking, the scene with DiCaprio and the psychiatrist or psychologist played by Vera Farmiga, the way he dismantles her is brilliantly written, I think, and believable.
I love those scenes.
And
yeah,
great
absolutely.
Scenes. But, you know, even though it is very similar to Infernal Affairs and some of the same scenes are there, it is very different as we've talked about it, and it's more flawed, but I think it's more ambitious than Infernal Affairs. So mm-hmm. I guess I'm kind of coming down on the side of it's like a good cover version. Despite those flaws that we'll talk about, I do love what Scorsese is trying to do with the psychological part and with the masculinity crisis. I think that's mm-hmm. all really fascinating, and it's true. You watch Infernal Affairs, they discover that there's a rat much quicker than they do here, and that becomes the whole story. It sets everything up. And here that scene comes way later, this raid scene, which is a lot less effective here.
Yeah.
This raid scene where, you know, Damon's character has to tip off Nicholson that the cops are there and ready to take him. That happens way later in this film because Scorsese spent so much time, as you said, setting up who these characters are, where they came from, why psychologically they've made certain choices. And I bought in to all of that. So, you know, I have to say, too, just real quick, that the acting, you know, we'll get into more of it, but especially DiCaprio, he always surprises me. Yeah. I said that I feared that Andy Lau and Tony Leung, I didn't see how these guys would be able to match the gravitas of those characters. And they're very different, but they're probably equally as good, or at least I think DiCaprio is. I actually think he's better here than Damon. I never give DiCaprio credit. I see things, and for example, I saw the trailer. Did you see the trailer for DiCaprio's new movie?
Yeah, the Blood Diamond. Yeah.
You hear him doing this accent, and you're going,
it's like a South African
oh
accent,
my God. I'm never going to be able to sit through that film. Just like you watch part of the trailer of The Departed and you hear him trying to do this Southie accent, and you're like, I can't sit through 2.5 hours of that. And then you come to find out he's actually totally believable. The accent's fine.
Yeah, it's
he's
fine.
Great. So I watch Blood Diamond, and I think, well, maybe it's actually going to be okay, because I always go in doubting him for some reason, and then he works for me. And here he's a lot more emotional, less stoic than Tony Leung, mm-hmm. but he's this firecracker waiting to go off, and I found that really intense and fun, and I thought he pulled it off perfectly.
Well, it's interesting. You bring a couple things I want to get to. First, like you said, the hour is full. The first hour is full of this, like you said, testosterone, ball-busting. It's a lot of fun to listen to. Your point about Mamet is well taken. And it's fun. And I was trying to remember what the original was like. What was Infernal Affairs like? Because I certainly don't remember it being that funny. And I also, and I ended up coming to the realization that the Infernal Affairs captures some sense of existential crisis. I went back and took a look at it, and I was reminded that, you know, Tony Leung's character has been undercover for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we get the sense that, you know, Damon's been undercover for, you know, a couple of years maximum.
Maybe, yeah.
And DiCaprio, undercover, you know, for a year and a half, maybe.
Yeah.
And there's this sense where Infernal Affairs, even though it is, I think, lighter in terms of its ambitions, it still has more a sense of the existential crisis of the characters in terms of, you know, losing their identity. You know, this undercover cop, at what point does he become a criminal, having to live the criminal lifestyle?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this case, Scorsese has made a well-cast kind of, and there are ambitions, but it's largely just a piece of entertainment. And I mean that in a kind of dismissive tone. I never felt like the comic tone you said at the beginning, the fun comic testosterone tone of the beginning, didn't for me add any layers of depth to the experience.
Okay.
And I, you know, we talked about this. I don't want to talk about the final scene at all, but the payoff of some of the stuff, some of the payoff of the suspense had a profoundly different impact mm-hmm. on the audience that I saw it with and on me than did Infernal Affairs, which is dark in many ways.
Yes.
Where this isn't. And I think there's a lot of banter and it's really fun, but for me that added up to something that was less ambitious in the end.
Okay. I didn't see it that way. The payoff in Infernal Affairs is better. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
We'll get into the ending of this film a little bit. I think we have to and how it's flawed.
But
obviously I disagree. I think this film is more ambitious. I think Infernal Affairs is more about, which isn't to say it doesn't get into the existential stuff. It's all there. But I think it is more about entertainment. It's more about that suspense of keeping you on the edge of your seat, of these people trying to find out who each other are. And that is really effective. As I said, I love this film. But when you add up all the layers that Scorsese is dealing with here, you add up we really get into who these people are. We don't have a sense, really, of who the people are in Infernal Affairs. We just buy them in the story because the writing is good and the acting's good and the directing's good, and we play along. Scorsese really fleshes these characters out, I think. And so for me, by the end, and again, you get into all this masculinity stuff where there's these kind of, I don't know if it all is effective, but the sexual inadequacy that comes up,
sure.
The homosexual jabs that keep coming up in the film, the violence of it.
Yeah.
It's just, it's different for me. It's just as effective. Maybe obviously for you, it wasn't as effective. So, you know, I don't agree, obviously. I think it is ambitious and all that stuff, especially that first hour, like I said, for me was just the most fun I've had.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you too, because I had this interesting experience and I think it had a lot to do with context, and it made me think other films that I would have this experience with if I saw it under similar circumstances. I walk in, and I'm sitting behind an African-American couple. Early, Jack Nicholson's narration, he talks about the other criminal elements
of the
city.
He drops the N-word.
Drops the N-word early.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I was just, okay, why then? It made me question why he would use that, or why, you know, what is Jack Nicholson's character? What am I supposed to think about him? He's obviously been given some sense of like narrative power by, it's the first voice we hear.
Sure.
He's bringing us into this culture. What gives him legitimacy, and should I be listening to him? Should I trust him? And he's very, very offensive, not only to the black community, but to the Latino community. And it's the kind of off-the-cuff offensiveness that, for me, again, bothered me. Just like,
I can't believe that.
And it did. I mean, it really, because it didn't really add up. It didn't really contribute.
It makes complete sense
in that
situation.
How?
That's exactly how that guy would talk.
Yeah, he does talk that way. But then I ask myself, how am I supposed to feel about Costello and his gang? And I think there is a sense of Scorsese wanting us to be charmed by him or like his power or his charisma. And at the same time, he never undermines that community. It's never like he never vilifies Costello necessarily. And
I disagree completely.
He does.
He's actually, despite Nicholson's performance, a complex character where you're asking yourself throughout. At times you find yourself caught up in his charisma. At equal times, and maybe too often, you find yourself realizing that the guy is, like you said, a slime ball, and I actually think it goes
too
far.
That's all he is. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't agree.
Complex. I don't see why anyone is loyal to him. Why is anybody loyal to him?
I think the first time
Damon sees him in the diner, he buys him a bunch of groceries. He also, you know, basically calls the waitress behind the line a whore and is very offensive
and brutal. By the end of it, he charms her, doesn't he? Somehow.
Well, because they film it that way.
Sure.
I wouldn't be charmed by what, you know, Nicholson, how he's behaving. I think it's an outrageous performance. Let's just get into
it.
I think it's completely outrageous.
It is.
I mean, it's flawed in a way. I mean, I think the original story, and they transplant it very well, the sense of parallels, where you get these two father figures, Martin Sheen, father figure to DiCaprio, and, you know, supposedly you've got the Nicholson character being a father figure of sorts to Damon's character. But... and Martin Sheen, it's almost over the top. Early on, you have Martin Sheen saying to DiCaprio as a way of convincing him to go undercover, do it for me. And you're like, this guy just met him. What's going on here? But you buy it because it's Martin Sheen.
Yeah.
You know, but Nicholson is nothing but brutal. And that, there are even additional scenes of him like spraying coke on a bed and telling a girl to like, you know, don't stop until you're numb. And you're just like, what? What is going on here? What am I supposed to feel about him? There's nothing appealing about the world that he lives in or any of the other criminal element. It's like, why wouldn't Damon like just make a phone call, wipe out the entire gang, have his life with the penthouse and wife? And
I think at some point he kind of comes to that conclusion.
He kind of does, but why doesn't he come to it earlier?
I agree with you, though. As much fun on some level it is to see
Nicholson, he is a complete distraction.
I got to give a credit to one of our listeners, John Dagan, Sarasota, Florida. He writes, here's my pitch for her surefire hit with critics and audiences alike. Jack Nicholson does cocaine and makes funny faces. Oh, that crazy Jack. He's at it again with the drugs and the hookers and the eyebrows. 2 hours of scenery chewing fun with no irrelevant plot getting in the way. Clearly, this is what Scorsese was after with The Departed, only to have those meddling studio heads insist that there be a plot and scenes that are relevant to it, because let's face it, Jack's scenes are from a completely different movie.
I agree.
There are some scenes in the film that are there to add just a darkness, I think, to his character and maybe a layer of evil or something, but they aren't necessary. They're the extra stuff that Scorsese adds to this film, or that he lets Nicholson
film. Absolutely.
And he thinks they're fun, so he puts them in there. But it's the kind of stuff that Infernal Affairs, being much more tightly wound and more focused, is more effective on some level, because it doesn't have that extra crap that you don't need in it.
Right.
And here, you know, like maybe Ed Norton ran over his director in Down in the Valley.
Nicholson clearly
Scorsese
did.
Let himself get run over.
It was a huge mistake. You know, I feel the same way. We don't need to get into it, but about Schmidt, where I know a lot of people praise that performance, but for me, it's a complete distraction that Nicholson is in it. I mean, there's the center of gravity of this film gets disrupted by the performance, by the existence of Nicholson in this film. You go back and watch the other one, Sam. You know, the gang leader in that film. He's a small time criminal in a much larger world of criminals in the Hong Kong underworld. In some way, he's powerful, he's charismatic, but he's never over the top, and he's
more mysterious.
He offers that parallel, you know, but he's powerful,
right?
But he doesn't overdo it, and so all of a sudden Martin Sheen's character becomes minimized and diminished to Nicholson's titanic personality. And it really, I think with better casting and a better performance, this would be a tighter film and a more interesting film.
I agree. I think it would be more interesting with someone else in that role, someone a little more understated. And I do feel, too, that, you know, by the ending of the film, the very ending of the film is actually, he actually uses what I think, he gets too clever for his own good with the visual imagery of the
shootout.
End of it.
Well,
after the shootout at the end, actually, I'm literally talking about the closing shot of the film.
Yeah.
It's actually, for me, so on the nose, I can't believe Scorsese did it. And you do see the bigger thing that blew me away is the cynicism of Infernal Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Scorsese actually ends this film on a much more positive, or I should say, just note. I can't believe that of all people, Scorsese would decide to do that. So that little...
It's as Hollywood as you can make this story.
It's as Hollywood as you can make it. That little adjustment that Scorsese makes to the end. I can't believe he did it. It doesn't work, and you can see it coming a mile away. And just in general.
Oh, yeah.
Again, what's great about Infernal Affairs with the tightness of everything and the focus on identity and them finding each other, this movie does become way too convoluted. You start thinking later about scenes that are in it, and you realize not just the Nicholson scenes, but certain plot scenes.
Yeah.
You realize, you know, this whole thing about the Chinese government and microprocessors. I mean, talk about a MacGuffin, you know. I mean, it's just like things become bigger and more complicated than they need to be.
Yeah.
And some scenes just don't even make sense. There's a scene where DiCaprio goes in and gets some information from a snitch.
Right.
Why he's there and what he's supposed to do and what he does do and the information he gets, it's all unbelievable. It's all there just because the plot needs it to happen. There's certain things that just don't work about that. And we should say at the end, you asked me this in an email, did the crowd laugh at the end of this film? And my crowd laughed
at the end of this film. Mine too, yeah.
Because let's just say about 10 people seem to get whacked in about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And the problem with it is that I think people are just kind of shocked. I knew it was coming.
Sure.
I've seen Infernal Affairs.
Right.
But still, there are new characters added, and there's new wrinkles to it that are added that are unnecessary, literally unnecessary, and you don't understand why some of the characters are even standing there.
Yeah. You have to ask yourself certainly that about Mark Wahlberg's character.
Yeah.
You have to say he's only there in order to fulfill the ending in some way.
Yeah.
But
the trailer gives it away.
Yeah,
by
that's true.
The shot of Mark Wahlberg in the trailer tells you how this film's going
to
end.
But Wahlberg, too, you have to ask, like, the way he's written, you're like, what did Nicholson do to that character to make him so fueled up and furious? I mean, it's a funny performance. Wahlberg's a blast to watch.
Yeah, he's great.
But by the end of it, you're like, what is this guy's problem? What's fueling this rage and this, like, you know, this jaded cynicism?
See, I think
it's a lot of fun to watch.
I think that's just the characterization of this setting and these South Boston
Again,
characters.
It's weirdly ambitious and also small. I mean, it's in terms of the way we see Boston,
sure.
the way we see the department, there's one scene early in Infernal Affairs. I just took a look at a few things, just went back and saw the end just to remind myself exactly what happened. Really moving. I did not have any instinct to laugh at the end of that film.
Yeah.
And part of it's just the way it's scored. But you have an early scene in Infernal Affairs that just, you see the Matt Damon character, Andy Lau, just doing his job. You don't see any, Matt Damon is never doing his work that has something that is unrelated to the Costello, the investigation. And I feel like just one little scene, you see a couple scenes of DiCaprio just going out with the hoods, and that sort of fills out that world in some way. But again, it's like there are a few things that could have been a little differently just to give a sense of the larger, larger world.
I think
here.
The big problem with Damon's character is, and I actually on some level give credit to Scorsese for making a guy just be bad.
Mm-hmm.
He's bad. Damon's character is actually just a bad dude, even though it's great early on that he's so funny and likable and charismatic. And that's what Damon pulls off really well,
and the
dialogue pulls off. But I give him credit for being willing, and Damon being willing to play such a bad guy. But at the same time, the whole drama of Infernal Affairs is that Andy Lau's character is a good person who's doing bad.
Yeah.
Okay? It really is. Like, you recognize that he's doing things because he has allegiance to this character.
But you believe
but
that,
never,
too.
He never really wants to cross the line, though. Damon crosses the line
early enough,
100 times in this film. And so then, by the end, he becomes, you know, kind of this Iago, you know, Shakespearean villain or something. But he's not as complex, and he's not as interesting because of that. Because you actually stop having any sympathy for him at all.
I was
you don't empathize
say that
with him at all.
Early, right.
And the beauty
true.
Of Infernal Affairs is you have empathy for both characters.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Okay. All right. Well, if you've seen The Departed and agree.
Did I mention that I love this film?
Apparently. So you loved it.
No, I loved it. Yeah, I don't know if that came through.
Because you loved the first hour, but it also carried over until the second half hour.
It decreases. My excitement, my giddiness wanes as the film goes on.
All right.
But I still love this film. The performances, the editing. I didn't even get into how great this film was edited. We'll have to talk about
that
in another part.
All right, maybe we will. And we can talk about the scoring a little bit, too. I liked the film. I don't want to, I mean, I spent a lot of the time dismissing it. I liked it. I think people are going to have a good time.
I say you just got to watch both films.
Agreed.
Okay.
All right. If you agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
All right. Well, recently on the show, we reviewed The Last Kiss,
Garden State 2.
We all wanted to call it. Well, here we've got Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah,
Eternal Sunshine 2,
Part
maybe.
Part 2.
We'll review Michel Gondry's The Science of Sleep. And I found some backers, some supporters of my
You're
going to
ruin
Nelson
your reputation here.
Disdain.
Going down the wrong path.
We'll get
hell.
Into that next in listener feedback. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and this is the part of the show where we announce the PureFlix DVD giveaway winner, or at least we're going to announce again the DVD we're giving away.
Right.
The special 3-disc edition of The Maltese Falcon just came out on DVD last week, and we will announce the winner in the notes for this show, so go to filmspotting.net and check out and see if maybe you're the lucky winner.
Yeah, sign up for a free PureFlix account now by going to pureflix.com/filmspotting or filmspotting.net. And you'll be entered to win this week Robert Altman's A Prairie Home Companion. We reviewed it back on Film Spotting 106. We both really, really liked it.
Yes,
I think
we did.
You know, I think it was both in our top 10
yeah.
of the year so far back in June, July. Also out this week, The Exorcist, The Complete Anthology, Adam Sandler's Click, Art School Confidential, among my most anticipated films of the year.
That you haven't even seen.
Still haven't seen it.
How much were you anticipating it?
Not very much. Apparently Matt Singer, though, our friend Matt Singer.
Yeah.
This is in his top five. I think he says this is number 3 film of the year
so far.
He's
like the one, he writes for the Village Voice,
IFC. It's his Down in the Valley.
He likes it. It's his Down in the Valley, which he completely agrees with me on.
I know.
We'll
get to that
another show.
Also, Waist Deep with Therese Gibson and The King with William Hurt and our friend Gael García Bernal. And speaking of Gael García Bernal, the star of Michel Gondry's The Science of Sleep.
Hi, welcome back. Tonight, I'll show you how dreams are prepared.
Love, friendships, relationships, and all those ships.
Hello? Are you trying to mock me on the air?
If you close the door.
So what's your name?
Stefan.
Stefan, Stefanie, click, click, catch, match. She has no boyfriend.
After the death of his father, Stefan, played by García Bernal, the child of a Mexican father and Parisian mother, has been invited by his mother back to Paris to take a job as a designer in a shop that designs and sells calendars. He speaks little French, but enough Spanish and English to get by. Also, he frequently confuses his dreams for reality and vice versa. His neighbor, Stephanie, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, is a musician and artist, and maybe Stefan's soulmate. Adam, we talked about Michel Gondry last week during our future directors of the future. We both really love his Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but Sunshine and his previous film, Human Nature, were both written by the greatest screenwriter working today.
So
nothing
you say.
Like overstatement, so I say. Charlie Kaufman. And here we've got Gondry writing and directing. And writing and directing a film about dreams. And as we all know, try telling somebody your dreams so vivid and compelling in sleep, so incomprehensible and boring in the waking state. Has Gondry found a way to tell you his dreams that doesn't bore you to tears?
Wow, that's a really good question, because the fact is with this film, which I enjoyed very much, it is like a prolonged dream.
Yeah.
The character is basically constantly dreaming, and it becomes hard for him and us to discern reality from his dreams. And so like a dream, you're exactly right. Trying to explain it to someone, it just usually doesn't make
right,
sense. And
yeah.
if you read plot descriptions of this film,
yeah, good luck.
They don't make any sense. They talk about how like the character is trying to snap out of his dream world to fall in love or do certain things, and you're
really?
Like, actually,
yeah.
you never no. really see that happen. Like,
yeah.
there's no plot
no.
that you would expect in any conventional sense with this film. So, kind of throw out all those
those
all
notions.
Those plot descriptions
right,
that
right.
you're reading. It's just not there.
Right.
But it's funny because you bring up Kaufman, and here he is without Kaufman, and yet this film feels like a Charlie Kaufman film. And
yeah.
Michel Gondry wrote it on his own. He's welcome. That's fine with me. He doesn't need Kaufman. I'd love to see them collaborate, but obviously they have very similar sensibilities
yeah.
in terms of style, but in terms of thematic subject matter. And I love that notion, the opening of the film, of dreams being like you're on a television show.
Yeah.
I can see that. I can see characters. I can see us viewing it that way. And I like this idea that overlaps with Kaufman of as depressing as it is in some way, this notion that you can't really be happy, or that love is kind of unattainable,
mm-hmm.
except in your dreams or in memory, through memory, like it is in Eternal Sunshine. So even mm-hmm. though that's kind of cynical, I can relate to it.
Not just cynical, though. I think it's a way of perceiving reality.
Yeah,
I
agree completely. And I just want to say that when you get to the end of the film, I'm not giving anything away, but the meanness that he has, that Gael Garcia Bernal's character, the things he says to this character, to Charlotte Gainsbourg at the end of the film, as zany as this movie is, there are so many moments like their ending discussion that are so real, that are moments where characters say things to each other that are so hurtful, and actually you're taken aback by it. Like, you can't believe he said it, and at the same time, you know that that's how you'd feel in that situation. Right. Like, and whether or not you'd say it, you'd want to say it.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, this is something I hope we get to a little bit, but it's not just that he's saying mean things. He's alternating them with incredibly loving and thoughtful things. I mean, saying like, are you ever going to get your teeth fixed? With, sometimes I wear jeans for a week just so it reminds me of you.
Yeah.
Again, out of context,
but
sounds a little strange.
But that's an insult too, though, isn't it?
Not
because
really.
He's commenting
it
how she
shows
never changes
how much
her clothes.
He pays attention to her and how much he knows her and wants to be with her, however he is.
Yeah.
This is my favorite film this year.
Really?
I absolutely loved it. And, you know, the whole, you know, like Stefan, we don't know ultimately if we're in a dream or reality. By the end of it, I think Gundry does a wonderful job filming this movie coherently, where at the beginning, we know when we're in reality and when we know we're in the dream world. By the end of it, it's unclear.
It is.
It's unclear where we are, and I think that's really sophisticated the way he deals with that. And thanks to Michel Gondry, by the end of this, I was unsure where I was. I walked into this theater, and it made me realize like how rare an experience a movie like this is for me, you know, where you walk out of the theater, and for me, I was expecting people to like lose a sense of gravity or grow wings and fly away for a horse to gallop through the movie lobby. And it reminded me, strangely, of the experience of watching a David Lynch movie.
Yeah.
Here you have a movie that is not just like a write what you know kind of experience, but somebody who is able to reflect the way they see the world onto film.
Mm-hmm.
You really get not only Stefan's perspective of reality, which is this confusion of dream and reality, but also Gondry's. And you have to think this is a very, very personal film.
Sure.
And that you get a chance, you get a glimpse into how somebody with a superior active imagination might perceive the world. And I love, too, that this film doesn't necessarily just celebrate or heroicize the dreamer and make a film about him being misunderstood by the world.
Right.
I mean, you get a lot of people that are willing to work with Stefan and his perception of the world, and it celebrates him, but it also says it's a huge burden.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge burden to see this. And you don't see Stefan necessarily trying to, you know, break free of the burden of dreams.
No, it's safer.
It's safer.
Yeah.
But he also realizes the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the movie is just brilliant, brilliant emotionally, visually and imaginatively, but the way he puts on screen, like the way this relationship comes together, you know, and how hard love is, even when it's completely meant to be. That's unlike anything I've really seen before. The moment when Stefan realizes that he's fallen for Stephanie is the exact moment we have, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to Gondry's credit.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, except in your love for it. I guess, you know, I saw this film on a Thursday night or a Wednesday night in Nashville at about 11 p.m.
Right.
And I was exhausted. And I'll just frankly admit that, like, for me, walking out of the theater, all I could think about was going to bed.
Yeah.
I didn't have that transcendent experience.
Yeah.
I didn't have that transcendent experience that you had. But I still really did enjoy the film. And I just love, going back to the Kaufman films and Eternal Sunshine, the playfulness of the film. There are things that you see in a Gondry film, not just visually, but actually just the way the characters behave and the writing that you don't see in other films. There's this great scene where Garcia Bernal is explaining his vision for a calendar, disasterology, and it's hilarious. His delivery of it,
his sincerity.
Garcia Bernal is so
he's
great
amazing.
In this film. He's amazing.
He is absolutely amazing.
I agree. And he's explaining this whole thing about like famous moments of disaster.
Every country has its disaster.
Disaster, right? And he's explained to his boss, who couldn't care less, what he his vision for this. And he's describing one of the scenes. And this character, Guy, isn't that his
name?
Guy,
yeah, the co-worker.
His co-worker who's
his
off the wall.
Middle-aged co-worker.
He's laughing hysterically. Like, he's in the background just like not even remotely
almost, yeah.
trying to hide the fact that he finds this like so comical that he's actually bugging their boss with this crate. And the fact that then Garcia Bernal is equally unflappable, like equally unmoved by that. He's not deterred at all by the fact that his coworkers are laughing at him. He's that committed to what he's saying. Those scenes, I think you almost only get in a Gondry film, and I love it. And I have to say, too, going to IMDb, I looked up some of the memorable quotes from this film. Just rereading some of the lines.
Laughing out loud, yeah.
I was laughing out loud at some of the lines. There's this great scene, you know, where he tells her that he likes her boobs. They're simple and unpretentious. And he says, at one point he describes something as, it's like touching your penis with your left hand. And she says, I don't have a penis. And he says, but you have a left hand. I laughed at all those moments.
Again, it's deadpan. There's a moment. It's also how that character communicates. I mean, the way he communicates is in dream language in some way. You know, that's how he perceives the world. And I can't say enough about Garcia Bernal. I mean, this film requires a collaborator. Gondry requires a collaborator. Otherwise, you can imagine a character just being overwhelmed by the vision, you know, of this film. Garcia Bernal is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the way he guides you through it, you require him being there as a viewer to guide you through it, that you understand his motivations in every moment,
right,
which are sometimes conflicting in a second.
He's so smart as an actor.
Unbelievably
smart. You're right, because he captures so many conflicting things at one
simultaneously.
Time. The humor of it, the anguish of it, it's all there.
Yep.
And you know, charisma, that word we use a lot. But I mean, just in being compelling on screen and being funny.
Yep.
It's all there.
Yeah, as good as Gosling was in Half Nelson, and I know we're getting that, and maybe we'll use this as a transition.
Yeah.
I think this is the performance of the year in terms of what he had to achieve. And I love that Gondry also fills his... You mentioned Guy, his coworker.
Uh-huh.
Everyone exists in this as this kind of dream chorus. They exist simultaneously as real people, but also as subjects in the dream world,
right,
as well. And it's almost this very fine line that, again, becomes more transparent as time goes on. And I can't say enough about this film. I could have sat there and watched it again. I mean, really just a thrilling movie to watch.
Not that it matters, but to put a cap on this, is it better than Eternal Sunshine or right up there?
I think it was more satisfying for me.
Really?
It really was. Like,
not for me, but...
Just because I think the movie... I think Kaufman is a genius, and there's a cleverness to and a kind of a cold scientific kind of cleverness to Kaufman that draws attention to itself. It's brilliant. It's like Aaron Sorkin's writing on
Studio
60. It's like it's brilliant and you're amazed by it, but you're also aware of
aware of it.
Gondry is just like, it's organic, and
that's true. No, I'll give you
good
that
stuff.
Okay, well, let's we recommend that, obviously.
Absolutely.
Let's stay in the art house. Let's get in a little bit to Half Nelson. I have been waiting because we discussed this last week on the show.
Right.
We reviewed Half Nelson. I tried to express my... I inarticulately tried to express how conflicted I was about this film. I did ultimately recommend it and say I liked it, but did not love it like you did it, and like all the critics seemed to like it.
Lumping me in with all the critics.
Well, for once,
I usually do for you.
That's right. You call me Mr. Mainstream, so now I get to do it to you. And I got to thank Chris Van Neville in St. John, Indiana. He wrote in, he said that he found David Poland's review of Half Nelson.
Yeah.
I couldn't find it online. I'll put a link to it in the notes for this show.
Right.
It's on his blog. Again, if you want to find it and read it, I'll put a link to it on our site. But Dave Poland from Movie City News and The Hot Button, I think, is his blog. And he wrote about Half Nelson, and I just want to share briefly some thoughts, because I said I had issues with the movie. And it's funny that he starts out talking about how false the movie is. And it's great, Sam, because the three movies he compares it to, or at least just mentions indirectly as it being false, are three movies you loved. Superman Returns, Mission Impossible 3, and The Devil Wears Prada.
I noticed that. It's amazing.
Only MI3 I liked from that bunch. So the bottom line is, Sam, you are false.
It's funny that this is a certain sense of falseness, because I'm always pointing it out.
Yeah.
It's like one of my pet peeves when I talk about like Little Miss Sunshine. I'm like, well, no, ultimately at its core, it's false. And he's using the exact same language.
Yep. And here's one of his...
it's a personal attack.
His lines that I'll use, that I think he articulates this pretty well. And it's something that I was trying to articulate.
Yes.
He says, watching a movie in which the crack dealer maintains an even demeanor, even an honorable position, is a cool movie turn. And when he turns out young Dre to deliver on her way to being a part of the dealing team, we worry for her. But the movie doesn't ask us to hate him. He's doing the best he can in a bad, bad world. Dre's brother is in prison, but he gets a pass because he doesn't rat out his friends. Dre's mom is working hard, so her lack of awareness and willingness to shake her finger about Dre seeing Frank while also stashing his money in her purse is okay. Even Dan's clumsily attempted rape late in the movie, and we're not going to have time to get into this, but our listener Tasula really wrote in about this. Maybe on a later show, we can. Even his clumsily attempted rape late in the movie is excused by the film because he is lost and the woman was once a happy sexual partner of his. I agree with what he's saying there.
I agree with what he's saying, but I don't see exactly how that works as a criticism. I mean, where exactly does the criticism lie in that?
Because it's false.
I don't see how it's false, though. It's. I mean, every movie is written to solve a dilemma, a problem. Like, what is the subject of this film? How do we write characters that help us, investigate this dilemma, this problem?
Sure.
That's what. But how is that? You're basically saying like, well, then movies are false because they are written and not documentaries.
Here's what I'm saying, and I hate to keep piling on poor Peter Davis from Hearts and Minds, but it's a similar conflict there. It's trying to do one thing, trying to be one kind of film, a very real, gritty film that isn't showing you all the mechanics at work, and at the same time, showing you all the mechanics at work.
I think it does. I would never say that the film is trying to be real necessarily, other in its performances. The performances are very real. We talked about this. You can't look at this film without noticing or being aware of its traditions in some way. It's the teacher that is like the single force of good in a young urban youth's life, except this movie flips it on its head.
Okay.
And it's doing that very intentionally. Well, instead of the teacher looking after the student, you've got the student looking after the teacher. I think it knows exactly what's
going on. Well, let's get a little more intense here with this. I feel so sorry. I said that there were no critics out there that had a problem with this film.
Apparently,
poor Armin White from
New
York Press.
Where did you find Armin White?
Right. In the Dave Pollan article.
A conservative rag.
There was a link to it, yes. Armin White, who I have to say, the fact that I'm agreeing in any shape or form with Armin White is bizarre, because he used to be invited to the Slate Movie Club, which was my favorite thing to read at the end of the year with David Edelstein and A.O. Scott and all these critics. And
Stephanie
Armin White,
Zachary.
Would always stop by, and I always found him infuriating. And the thing is, like, I think he knows as a critic that that's his role.
Yeah.
Everything is always funneled through a prism of race, which is interesting, but at the same time, confounding. Sometimes you feel like he's looking for things that aren't there.
Yeah.
So that's Armin White. I've never really agreed with him in those forums. He writes about this film, and he really tears it apart. And I'm going to read part of it here. He says, "Half Nelson contains button-pushing references to history that intersperse each sequence and are read aloud by Dunn's naive students. The point here, their gradual indoctrination to liberal ideology and vague class struggle as a form of enlightenment. All this makes Half Nelson the fakest, most infuriating film on race relations since Boaz Yakin made a hero out of a 14-year-old ghetto Machiavelli who vanquished adult drug dealers in the 1994 Fresh. Sure enough, Yakin is thanked in the end credits of Half Nelson. I unthank him."
Wow, that's articulately written. I can't agree. I can't also disagree point by point. My only point is I think, like you said, this film is about race in some way. It's about the dialectic. It's about Marxism. It's about a lot of big ideas. And sure, I mean, just
and simple about them.
I think
it's really simple about them,
I don't
and the
think
way
it
uses them.
I don't think it is. And I think the movie at its core is about these characters. If it were really trying to be about, the Marxist dialectic in some way, or the capitalist dialectic, if it was really about that, I think it introduces the concept of the dialectic and then uses it to show the way forces, two characters' forces battle each other out, in terms of the tipping point that individuals feel in their lives. And I think, again, sure, the movie invites you to investigate or to challenge these subjects, and I can understand how somebody would perceive the film like that. I think it's much smarter and better than that, and more personal and specific.
Well, let's close with one last one I want to read, just because it hopefully will support my stance in some way, because really I don't know that, as I said, I felt like I was out all alone.
You're
going
to see it again and love it and feel bad you spent all this
time. I don't think so, actually.
I think so.
Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. I told you I couldn't believe that I found this. He reviewed the movie, liked it, 3.5 stars. He loved it, but he says, and if you remember our discussion, I pointed out this one scene in particular that was the scene where really the movie, for me, came off the tracks. And he says that the movie isn't perfect. He says, in the later scenes, you feel screenwriting machinations at work. Dre works as the drug dealer's gopher, and it's not hard to guess the identity of one of the clients. Also, there's something off in the scenes with Dunn and his hard-drinking parents, idealistic children of the 60s now lost in hazy liberal regrets. The key dinner scene is there for a reason, to show us what fed into one young man's addiction. But that's the problem. When a scene is clearly in a movie for one specific reason, a true-to-life picture suddenly becomes a less realistic one. That perfectly says what I was trying to say and spent 2 minutes saying and didn't hit on at all, is that was the moment where all of a sudden what Dave Pollan, I think, and what Armin White on a much grander level is saying is all of a sudden I realized the fakeness of everything. I realized the convenience of everything, and that scene doesn't work for me, and Michael Phillips nails it. Why? And I think it ties into something larger about the film that doesn't really work. I'm just glad, I guess, that there are some other voices out there. I don't know, whether they're right or wrong. We've got some listeners who have chimed in. We'll get to that at some other point, but I just wanted to mention that it isn't universally adored.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking for ways where a film doesn't work, this film is constructed, obviously constructed. It is not a documentary. It's not a matter of, like, actually literally discovering unknown people as they progress through life. This film is written, and I think, yes, you could criticize the construction of it. But I think what makes this movie different, or, you know, makes it better than the sum maybe of its construction of its parts, is that every scene feels real to me. And it never feels false. Never once felt false. And okay. I know false like nobody does.
I don't know, man.
Apparently I have special
not.
Glasses. Sam yeah. Van Halgren.
The synagogue.
Synagogues. Uh-huh. And I know I can see false. It shows up as like a dark green on the screen. Everything was true. It was bright red or
gotta take them in for a tune-up.
Crystal clear. You're so wrong about
okay,
this.
Okay, well, half Nelson. The debate will continue because it's going to come up at the end of the year, I have a feeling,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it will.
Okay, well, if you've seen The Science of Sleep or if you've now since seen Half Nelson,
yes.
Want to get in on the debate, tell us what you think. feedback@filmspotting.net.
When we come back, I make Adam promise to play the pimp next time on Massacre Theater. Plus, listeners fire up the flux capacitor to save more 80s movies from the ash bin of history. Stay with us.
Alexander, older brother.
You gonna feel different, man. I'm put you some new shoes tomorrow, man. And you gonna feel like you are in charge.
Dude. I know when you're messing with my head. Cause I let you. Cause sometimes my head needs to be messed with. But right now, just don't. Okay?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from Hustle and Flow. That was Terrence Howard as DJ and Taryn Manning as Nola and Craig Brewer's 2005 breakthrough film, a tie-in with last week's top five directors of the future. Maybe Craig Brewer got it, but if you've seen these trailers for Black Snake Moan.
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
Wowie.
Exactly.
All right, we'll reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner, main.
And the winner is Josh Youngerman from Wilmette, Illinois,
right
here in Local Wilmette. Congratulations to Josh. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Yeah.
Betty.
Yeah, Betty. Look, you don't rush it. I don't rush it. Okay? Now, we're going to play this nice and close, just like in the movies, okay?
All right, it's time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. But first, I don't know that Film Spotting listeners have ever agreed more on one thing,
it's
which
terrible.
Is that your Terrence Howard DJ was by way of Al Pacino and Tony Montana.
I can't get him out of my head. And we proposed maybe doing an entire show channeling
as Al Pacino.
Yeah. I'm not sure from which film. Maybe a series of films.
Maybe
depending on the segment.
I think Sam needs
to Scarface.
Be, you can be Pacino from The Devil's Advocate, for an
absolutely.
Entire show. I will be Samantha Morton from In America.
That's right. Agreed.
Who wouldn't want to listen
future,
to that?
On a future, as yet unnamed episode of Film Spotting.
That's going to be Film Spotting number 200. Yeah. Okay, well.
Absentee landlord. Yeah, there we go. I'm just warming
resist.
Up. I couldn't resist.
God. Okay, Massacre Theater. Tying in with our top five we're going to get to in the next
yes.
segment. Coolest characters, or I guess you
characters
could say,
you always wanted to be.
If I could be this character.
That's right, if I could be one character
so,
in the history of film.
Think about cool characters, and you start it, so
That's
I'll
right.
give you the action. And action.
I think you've made your point. Thank you for the demonstration.
Choose your next witticism carefully. It may be your last. The purpose of our two previous encounters is now very clear to me. I do not intend to be distracted by another. Good night.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, I expect you to die. There is nothing you can talk to me about that I don't already know.
And scene. It's weak. I want to redo it.
No, I was weak. Playing one of the great villains of all time.
I know.
It's brutal. Okay, well, if you know what film Sam and I just really massacred,
you've made your point.
Send us an email by Monday, October 16th. Obviously, we're massacring Trainspotting, right?
Clearly.
Yeah, you're playing Johnny Lee Miller.
Well done.
Monday, October 16th, feedback at filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. Okay, yes. So that's Massacre Theater. Sam, we've got some great feedback we're going to get into. 80s yes. movies, directors right. of the future. First, we got a bunch of red tape to take care of. Some listeners are wondering, hey, wait a second, yeah. documentaries marathon's
Where's
going
that?
On.
I didn't hear anything Where's, in the opening yeah. show.
Where's Errol Morris's Vernon, Florida? I have nothing to say except I couldn't
You're
get
lazy.
It watched. I've been too busy.
It's been really busy.
Things
I'll
have
vouch
been
for that.
Too crazy. I just said to Sam, with Departed and Science of Sleep, let's take a yep. break. And what we're going to do in a couple weeks, we're going to come back with our bonus edition of the podcast,
right.
The Wednesday show leading up to our Chicago Public Radio show.
Right.
We're going to review both Vernon, Florida and the next documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk, on that show.
Yeah,
so
I was honestly worried about you getting home at like 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, watching Vernon, Florida, and honestly, maybe missing the subtleties of what Morris has to do.
Okay, well, I'm so glad I didn't
I'm
put
glad,
it in.
I'm glad we put the brakes on
because it would have
that.
Been 2 a.m. last night that
I would
have been
just
watching
shamed
it.
Shamed
so, you. Yeah, you would have been. You would have shamed me, and it would
have
been
I would
have
schooled
bad.
You. Like, we should have done that. I've been waiting for that opportunity.
Well,
I'm like, clearly you once, missed what Morris
was trying to accomplish.
Once every
130 shows would be good for you, Sam. Okay, we want to thank everyone as well. Everyone who is so generous to donate through filmspotting.net. We appreciate it. Your nicknames will be on the site.
Yes.
Sam, a couple of quick corrections. We can't avoid
man,
a show
can't.
Without a couple of quick
the
corrections.
The ghost of Sven Nyquist.
Or Nyquist.
Nyquist,
yes.
yeah.
We actually had
You're right.
Arvid Sigvardsson, now mm-hmm. I can mispronounce his name, from Lund, Sweden. He wrote in, he says, we weren't far off the first
the
time.
The first time with
it's
Nyquist,
It's not Nyquist,
right?
it's actually Nyquist or Nyquist.
Nyquist.
So, and he points out, thank you, Arvid, that actually Nyquist was the DP on Woody Allen's New York Stories contribution.
Yes.
So actually, they collaborated four times. So that's great to hear. Apparently, he throws into some trivia that Sven and Mia Farrow were once
lovers. Yeah.
So that's an interesting bit of trivia. Yeah. Real briefly here, Stephen A. Mikalik, Carmichael's, Pennsylvania, points mm-hmm. out, Sam, you had your years wrong. Schindler's
not
List. Yeah, I know. It's not possible. Schindler's List was actually 91. Actually, 93. You said 91.
Yes.
You also said Zach Braff's Garden State was 2003. It was 2004.
Oh, God. You know what? I haven't blamed the intern in a while, and it's time.
It's time.
I just show up. I've got a list of notes.
You're the talent.
Years, dates. I'm the talent. I show up.
Okay. We also had, we thank TJ for pointing this out because some great moments of what we're calling coincidence spotting.
Right.
When things that are unplanned, they just synergy, things work out, and there are coincidences. And TJ wrote in from Plainfield, Illinois, and said that there's a scene in Half Nelson where one of the kids talks about the murder of Harvey Milk.
Yep.
And of course, he's coming up in the marathon. That's true. That was the
Absolutely.
First thing I thought about. And Sam, you wrote back to him when we talked about off air. Why don't you mention that one?
Yeah, Daniel
of course,
Ellsberg.
Half Nelson,
of course.
Another
Daniel
marathon.
Ellsberg, one of the most fascinating subjects of Peter Davis's Hearts and Minds,
right.
Really got one of the most powerful scenes, I think, in Hearts and Minds, is when Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers, famous for the Pentagon Papers, talks about Robert Kennedy being shot
right.
and breaks down.
It is, yeah.
It's incredibly moving. And of course, yes, in Half Nelson, you get the scene between Ryan Gosling and his mom, and he's saying, like, you stopped a war, Mom. Your whole generation stopped a war. And she says, no, Daniel Ellsberg stopped the
right.
war. So again, it's just, it makes the whole thing.
And we had just watched Hearts and Minds and then you
stuff.
See Half Nelson and great moments of coincidence spotting. So yep. Thanks for writing in about that, TJ. We have some poll questions here. Before we do that, one little bit of housekeeping we still need to get to. We wanted to actually say, if you've looked at our calendar, we had next week on tap reviews of maybe Sunshine, the new Danny Boyle film, I think,
right.
which we're curious about, and also Man of the Year, the Robin
you
Williams
are
movie.
Dreading.
Yeah, I am, Barry Levinson. But we're what's the term when you're upending a show or you're...
Yes.
I can't remember.
Preempting.
Preempting a
yes,
show.
Preempting.
We're not going to get to that show. We're actually going to spend the whole week on the Chicago Film Festival.
Which we have been credentialed for.
Yes. Unlike last year, we got the credentials this year, and we are actually going to have a chance to see some really interesting movies that are playing at the film festival, including some really interesting films. Risk Cutters, A Love Story.
Guide to Recognizing Your Saints.
A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints. I saw a trailer for it last night,
looks
actually.
Really good.
And it looks really interesting. Yeah. We're going to see all of those. We're going to talk about those. We're also hoping to have at least one guest on. I don't want to say too much until we finalize it, but we hope to have maybe one of the filmmakers we just mentioned on the show.
Right.
So look for that next week. Poll question,
yes.
Sam. marathon coming up after the documentaries marathon. We're doing animation, and we had one opening. We had to have a Miyazaki film.
Right.
We said, you get to pick it because we can't decide. Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, or Howl's Moving Castle. Listeners, which one has to be in the marathon? A lot of votes, and it was pretty overwhelming.
It was. 53% of you said go with Spirited Away. And you have to wonder, yes, that's probably the one that most people have seen. It was the most popular. I think it was one of the first that Disney bought the rights to and then released in the theaters with a dubbed version.
And is it the one that you
said? And it is the one that I've seen. But I, as I said, I'm actually looking forward to seeing it again in this whole context. And we do plan, hopefully, to see a sort of extracurricular, see a couple other, at least maybe one other Miyazaki film as we're going through the marathon. So hopefully we'll be able to refer to that as well.
And but as expected, we got so much feedback about this. Even here when we had it narrowed down to three, people were still writing in making their cases for other,
other
Miyazaki films.
Other,
no, you can't pick one of those three. Right. We appreciate every bit of it, but we are sticking with one of these three. And it is, we should say too, based on the number of emails we got originally from people saying one of these three.
That's
one of those three films that we're curious about kept coming up. And so we do appreciate everyone that's
really
passionate.
We know there's a case to be made for like a Miyazaki marathon all alone. Absolutely. We want to say that.
And maybe at some point we will get to
that.
So. Thank you to everyone for that, but Spirited Away is going to be the fifth film, actually, the sixth film we've chosen for our animation marathon. Again, thank you to everyone who contributed to that.
Right.
Okay, well, other poll question.
Yeah, this week's poll question, really simply, and hopefully this will encourage everyone that hasn't seen Infernal Affairs to see it so they can answer the poll question, is The Departed better than Infernal Affairs? Yes, no. Haven't seen both yet. Don't bother. Go see Infernal Affairs. Go see The Departed.
Don't say that.
Answer. All right. Haven't seen both yet or haven't seen either. So, again, I think hopefully our review encouraged you to go find the Infernal Affairs and also see The Departed, which we both agree is worth seeing.
Yeah, without a doubt. I feel more strongly
than
you do, but we want to know that from you. I'm curious how many people have seen Infernal Affairs, and I'd love to know of the people who have seen both, where do they come out on that question I posed to you at the beginning of our review. So, okay, well, let's get into the mailbag, Sam. And we spent a little bit of time last week on the 80s movies, but the feedback continues to come in. It's one of those top five topics that has clearly struck a chord with people. And one nerve that we really struck with people here, as we're going to say this. And we read one email last week that mentioned this film as like the number three or something in there.
Yeah.
But really, it just keeps pouring in. The one film that apparently film spotting listeners want to save from the 80s more than any other film.
Seriously.
It's right here. Let's get to this email from Casey, who says, hey guys, I fear for the future filmmakers of the world. You neglected to save one of the best examples of narrative structure ever committed to film. Back to the Future.
Yeah.
That's right.
Wow.
The 70s had Chinatown as the perfect screenplay. The 80s had Back to the Future. In the hands of filmmakers lesser than Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis, heck, even in the hands of the Robert Zemeckis of the last 10 years, this film would be an overplotted mess. Never has so much convolution been carried off so effortlessly. And with DeLorean, skateboarding, puffy jacket vest, cab, Pepsi Free, Calvin Klein, and Huey Lewis, Back to the Future is as much a time capsule of the 80s as it is a revel in 50s nostalgia.
It's the power of love.
Sam,
I was actually, listen, I heard, I have to say, like, this was the one film that got cut. I felt horrible about leaving this out. And I actually heard, I think as sort of like haunting me, I think it was on the way home after recording.
Yeah.
Huey Lewis came on the radio,
kidding.
The Power of Love.
Wow.
And it was a nostalgic shock to the heart. And I was like, I suddenly had a weird side note kind of fantasy. I was like, I want the White Stripes to cover The Power of Love.
Interesting.
It would be awesome.
Yeah.
But that song still sticks with me. And the scenes from the film, of him skateboarding over the bench and stuff like that.
It's all great stuff.
It is a great song. It's a great film.
Yeah.
And I think nothing better puts the 80s in a nutshell than saying, like, the 70s had Chinatown, the 80s had Back to the Future. We may agree.
We may.
That's still saying something a little disparaging.
And I just want to let everyone know, just so they understand how hard it was to leave off. Because for me,
because it's there burning on the fire.
Yeah, it came out. It is. You're right. It came out, I think, when I was in fifth grade.
85.
Yeah. And the end scene, or I'm sorry, the big musical moment of him doing Chuck Berry's Johnny Be Good.
Oh, man.
In fifth grade, we did a talent show where we did a fifth grade talent show where we did like a putting on the lips type thing.
I loved putting
that show?
On the lips.
Yeah, a lip syncing show.
I loved it.
We did a lip syncing thing, and I did
Johnny Be Good
as Marty McFly doing Johnny Be Good from Back to the Future, complete with sliding on the floor playing the guitar solo.
Where's the tape?
I was a total badass.
That's amazing.
Quick side note.
Elizabeth
it's kind of
Shue.
Funny.
Oh,
quick,
man.
Elizabeth Shue?
Isn't it you?
Leah Thompson?
Oh, God. I'm sorry. Can we edit that?
We can't now. I'm leaving it in.
Why did I say Elizabeth Shue needs to be saved
Karate
from the 80s
Kid.
As well.
Karate Kid.
Kid. God, I just, I have no integrity
you
left.
You have no credibility left after that, and I'm leaving
Elizabeth Shue,
in the show.
Adventures of Babysitting.
Yeah, that's true. Which I saw in the theater, by the way. But quick note that's kind of funny. Addendum to the Back to the Future Johnny B. Goode story.
Right.
So then, Grinnell, growing up in Grinnell, they have Happy Days every year where they have this, you know, this big festival downtown or whatever.
Yeah.
It's lovely. And they had a lip-syncing contest.
Oh,
so
no,
me and my friends, we decide that we're going to do Johnny B. Goode. We've got a guy playing the drums, and I'm playing the guitar and singing. And we're such morons. We go down there, and we tell the people, yeah, we're doing Johnny B. Goode. And they say, okay. We get up there to start performing, and Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode comes on.
Yeah.
Of course it does.
Not
the version
not Michael
of the
J. Fox's. Oh, no.
We didn't
You're
think
lost.
To bring our own tape. It was awful. It was
You're
completely
10,
different.
Let's say.
Yeah, we were like 10.
You're 10.
Anyway.
Don't
okay,
need,
well.
Don't need money. Don't need
Let's get to
fame.
A few more
don't
here.
Don't need no credit cards to ride this train.
That's true.
Yeah.
Go
All
on
right.
here. More Back to the Future love.
Josh Gerritsen writes, maybe it's the fact that I saw the movie when I was 13, but damn it, it was the coolest movie ever made. I've seen it over 300 times. My six-year-old daughter
Just
has seen it
about
at
that
least
for a
30
second.
Times. How many hours is that?
300 times? Is he serious?
I'm not going to doubt it.
I won't either.
One of our sports guy. How many times has he seen Hoosiers?
Yeah.
Over 100. My six-year-old daughter has seen it at least 30 times. I think it's playing on constant loop in Josh's house.
It could be.
Actually. And we both love it. No, it's not Raging Bull. And it's not Sophie's Choice. It's the quintessential 80s movie. Who hasn't dreamed of going back in time and changing things for the better and having their mom hit on them?
Yeah.
Josh didn't write that, but
okay,
I did,
he didn't.
So.
You threw that in. Last one here, even though we could read about 50 of them. Greg Fisher, Pella, Iowa.
Get
how can
your
you leave
damn hands off of her?
Yes. How can you leave Back to the Future off your list? You have a DeLorean built with a flux capacitor that uses plutonium to travel through time. Michael J. Fox is the ultimate teenage hero. Christopher Lloyd is the crazed scientific genius. Huey Lewis in the news blaring throughout the film as Marty McFly skateboards throughout the town. What's not to like about this film?
Nothing.
As a kid, I watched this movie 10 times in one weekend and never got tired of it. Now today, the trilogy sits proudly in my DVD collection. I feel sorry for your children that they will be deprived of seeing this creative and entertaining cinema experience. We may have to pull it back off somehow.
Do you know who's cringing right now?
Who?
Eric Stoltz.
Yeah.
Originally cast as Marty McFly. Uh-huh. I never forgot that piece of trivia. I think one of the first pieces of movie trivia.
Was there
that
anyone
I ever
more likable from the 80s than Michael J. Fox?
None. Nobody.
Family Ties.
Who can make capitalism likable? Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox. Teen Wolf, another 80s classic I loved. But I had to read Greg's email, too, because he's from Pella, Iowa, and I got to throw in the plug. Well, Yarsma's Bakery. If you're ever going through Pella, hit it up for some Dutch letters. Sam, they've got these things. They're called pillows, I think, or that's what we
pillows,
call them.
Yeah.
You know, and they're flaky and inside this cream.
Pella, Iowa. They're called Pellas
Dutch.
Or pillows?
No. Pella is the town.
Yes.
The delicacy is called pillows, or that's what we call them. But great Dutch, little Dutch town.
Yeah.
Great Dutch delicacies. You're now Dutch.
Van I am Dutch Van Hallgren.
So they would
I'm
accept
still waiting
you
to hear
with
from
open
the
arms.
Netherlands.
Yeah. They would
that takes
accept
a while.
You, maybe,
I think it comes
to get the official letter that, hi, you're
by,
Dutch.
By boat.
Yeah. We're going to take you to Pella sometime. You'll feel right at home.
I will. Naturally.
Okay. Let's read one here, Sam.
Yes.
Email that we got from
Future Directors.
Future Directors.
Yep.
And we'll get to some more in the next segment. But we did our top five future directors. Upcoming directors, the guys who are kind of have only made one or two films that we think are the stars to watch. And I have to say, Austin Luger in Carmel, Indiana really shamed me anyway, and I think probably you too.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote and said, I automatically assumed that you two would have your number one be Rian Johnson and your number two be Dylan Kidd, or vice versa. Sam's number three comes along and there's Ryan, then Adam's number two. So I'm waiting and waiting and realizing he's missing. Did you guys listen to Cinecast? Remember back when during those 100 episodes, one of which Dylan Kidd actually guest starred in? That's true. Cinecast number 100.
That's true.
Sam, I even believed you tolerated Laura Linney when you made a few comments on P.S. He might not have been on my list of upcoming directors, definitely screenwriters, but I thought he would be hailed for your list. It caught me off guard. Sam, do we have an excuse?
Well,
we love Dylan Kidd.
We do, but I have to say, I think when we look at the list of directors that we discussed on last week's show, I mean, as much as I love Dylan Kidd and as much as we love Roger Dodger, although I have to say primarily because of Campbell Scott's performance.
Yes.
And P.S. is interesting, and I think Laura Linney gives a great performance in that.
And our friend Topher Grace.
And our friend Topher Grace, of course. I have to say there's nothing about what he's done so far that really necessarily puts him in the same group as these, I have to say.
Maybe not.
And a little bit tidbit here. I've actually read Dylan Kidd's next film that he's going to be directing because it was co-written by Ira Glass, my ex-boss. So I know that this is going to happen. And so, I actually know the next project, and it's interesting.
Okay.
I think it has a lot of promise. It's a comedy, more of a straight comedy. So I do. I just thought, you know, I still will stick with my top five because I think what they've got going on is much more ambitious. We love Dylan Kidd. We can't wait to see what he does next. And maybe in the future he'll break the top five.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, if I could be one character, I would be.
Yes.
And I can't wait to hear Sam's number one, Mary Poppins. Just wait for it. It's going to happen. Stay tuned.
Just a spoonful of sugar.
Hi, Adam, Sam. This is Alex Mesnick from Dallas, Texas, and I'm responding to the Who Would You Be in the History of Film? And I've picked The Talented Mr. Ripley. One, because I would get to be Matt Damon, and two, I'd get to have a strange, confused relationship with Jude Law, and I get to kill people, and I get to live among others, and live among rich people and live off their money. And so that's who I'd want to be.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and that was our good friend,
oh,
our
Alex.
Message board moderator, Alex Nesnick in Dallas,
yeah,
Texas.
Guru.
Yeah, and got a really
an insight. I'm not sure Alex is maybe ready to share with the rest of the Film Spotting audience, but now we know.
His affection, shall we say, for Jude Law? Can't really blame him.
Nicely done.
He's a pretty man.
He's a pretty man.
He is a pretty man. Okay, well, we're going to get to even more top five fun with coolest characters we'd want to be. It's
yes.
pretty funny, actually, if you think about it. He wants to be the talented Mr. Ripley. That guy's just full of deception and
no.
gets himself in these awful situations.
I think Alex should be able to do a better...
a murderer.
And he's a murderer. And he's like, yeah, that's me.
That's me.
He's like, maybe I'll murder, maybe I won't.
That was in our application for message board moderation. Which
Love
character
lost.
Do you want to be? And we said, well, if you want to be the talented Mr. Ripley, you're our guy.
You're our guy.
Okay, we're going to get to a few more of those. We did want to share one quick bit of feedback, another director of the future, because
yeah.
this is someone that a couple people wrote in about.
That's
not
right.
only let's see, Brent we'll get to, and also our friend Brett Merriman in Menlo Park wrote in about him. Sam, why don't you take it? Brent from Atlanta, GA, he's got someone that we overlooked for
yeah.
future directors.
Yeah, here it's first on my list is Zack Snyder, who directed 2004's Dawn of the Dead remake. I do not know if either of you saw this film, but I do believe it to be zombie brilliance. He made the film very tense and frightening at moments, but at the same time made it a lot of fun to watch. He has a new film coming out in March called 300.
Sparta!
Oh, God. Get ready, people, if you haven't seen it yet. The trailer looks like it could be very interesting. I want to comment. Second on my list is Rob Zombie, Brent writes. This is a director who obviously loves film. It comes through in his filmmaking. If you haven't seen any of Zack Snyder's or Rob Zombie's films, I urge you to sit down on a rainy night and have fun. I know that neither director is a logical choice, but they both obviously love what they do, and I believe that they both deserved a quick mention.
Okay, well, they got their quick mention.
Yeah.
And it is funny because we get this coming yeah. off of Before the Departed.
We both saw the trailer for 300,
based on the graphic novels of Frank
By
Miller.
By my friend Frank Miller.
We know how much you love that, Sam.
The adolescent misogynist.
Yes. What was your reaction to 300?
I turned to Carrie and I said, I can wait for that. I am not looking forward to sitting through how many hours of that. I really, and it's this I'm already reviewing the trailer, but yeah. It's just like it looks and like only 2 hours
half and
alienating half our audience, because I know people will be excited about this. I couldn't have been less excited. It looks, to me, just looks awful.
I have to say, when it first started,
yeah,
I liked
the look of it. Absolutely.
I was like, okay, similar in some way to Sin City, this graphic novel thing.
Sometimes you can tell like how bad the acting's going to be just on the trailer, and here,
yeah, and just hearing the word Sparta like five times in 20 seconds, and just something about it, I have to say, turned me off too. So I don't know, but you know what?
We don't know.
Brett and Brent both sound like smart guys. We know Brett is. We've heard from him a lot. So
I know.
We're going to trust them, sort of. We'll wait till it comes out.
We'll wait, and we'll hold it over their heads.
We will, if it's not good.
If it's worthy of holding it over heads.
Well, Sam, coolest characters. I swear we owe a listener a debt of gratitude
for
this.
We probably do.
Okay, if we do, we'll put it in the notes.
Because I think at the time we're like, no, isn't that kind of like the top five badasses? But
yeah.
It turns out it's not.
Okay, yeah, because tying in with The Departed, you know, Nicholson plays these characters who are always cool.
Yeah.
And, so we thought, okay, coolest characters. Characters who we would want to be. Again, different than badasses, where with badasses, you kind of want to be them, but the fact is, for example, someone on my list, Don Logan from Sexy Beast, Ben Kingsley.
On your badass
list,
he's a
badass, but he's not someone I actually want to be.
No.
I wouldn't want to ever change places with Don Logan.
That's right.
Okay, so with that kind of criterion in mind,
yes.
Sam, set up your list of characters you want to be from cinema.
Well, I remember we talked about this, and you were hesitant to embrace this top five, and you said, oh, great, more testosterone, I think. And I said, well, what if we made our 6 through 10 the top five, female characters?
And
we
I shot that down in a hurry.
Not fast enough. I decided to go ahead and assemble my list, and it was interesting.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
You're going to do this?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I've got, and it's funny, though, the characters that they ended up being.
Carrie pushed you to this, didn't she?
I am a married man.
Yeah, well, I am too, but.
You don't talk to Sarah.
I still
about
have my
spotting.
Manhood, apparently.
But what's interesting is, like, two of my characters are children, because they're the most sort of, like, heroic characters, I think. Female characters in some way.
I've got
Nora Charles.
Okay.
You know, Myrna Loy.
Yeah.
The Thin Man. I've got Hilda Johnson, Rosalind Russell, in His Girl Friday.
Okay.
Smart, with it, sharp characters. Mary Poppins. And then I've got...
You just want the power, don't you?
The magic power, just a spoonful of sugar. And then I've got Fiona from The Secret of Ronin-ish. How awesome would that be?
Okay.
And then Paika from Whale Rider, Keisha Castle Hughes.
Everyone,
magical.
Don't say the film spotting hosts that we're, or at least
this
Sam,
female
is
perspective
not in
is
touch.
Brought to you by I don't know what.
Yeah, he's Sam is clearly in touch with his feminine.
My
side.
Only other criteria was that they couldn't be real life characters. No, so I had to eliminate The Right Stuff. Say
okay,
sure, or All the President's Men.
Sure. Yeah.
I do have one exception, however.
One exception.
And that will be revealed in the top five.
Okay. Yes. Well, all of mine, I believe, fall into that category. They're all fictitious characters. My 6 through 10, sorry, I'm sticking with masculinity here.
Oh, I have a 6 through 10, too.
Oh, well, sorry. You used your 6
what?
Through
no.
10. There's no way you get to say that. Your 6 through 10 was your female character.
No, I'm going to say it anyway.
No, I'm laying down the law, Sam. Okay, you only get 1 through 6, 6 through 10. It's not the 15.
I am offering a female perspective.
That's your 6 through 10.
I'm going to say it anyway.
My 6 through 10. I'm going to edit it out. My 6 through 10. I've got the man with no name, Clint Eastwood.
Really?
Really. I've also got, yes, I do. I also have the first character the second character I ever really, truly imitated and wanted to be, Maverick from Top Gun.
Oh, good call.
Thank you. I've got the Sundance Kid.
We're going to make it with Kelly McGillis.
Yes. I've got the Sundance Kid, of course, Robert Redford.
Oh, that's
I
good.
Also have, here is my olive branch to our listeners, Marty McFly.
Well done.
I mean, seriously, sure. He's the coolest guy in the world. He's funny, and the skateboarding stuff is fantastic, and he plays the guitar, and he's
cool
got a smoking hot girlfriend.
Yes, he does.
So Marty McFly
Elizabeth
is on
Shue
my list.
So good in that.
Yeah. Actually, she's kind of looks like Elizabeth Shue.
A little bit. I always confused them back then.
I can't remember what her name is. But then lastly, this may be kind of an odd choice because he's in the film for such a short amount of time, but he's mythic in the way he's characterized. And for what we see of him, we buy it. Buddy Deeds from Lone Star. Matthew McConaughey.
Oh, nice.
This guy
That's
who
good.
Is so revered and is willing to take on.
That's interesting.
With no fear.
Yeah.
Kris Kristofferson's Sheriff Wade. He's a badass in his own way. I would like to be Buddy Deeds.
I'm sorry. I have to do my 6 through 10 because... I want to do one of my 6 through 10. I'm going to leave it up to
you,
listener.
Got,
I'm going to leave it up to my
list. 20 seconds.
Listener, Nathan Chandler, take it away.
Hey guys, this is Nathan Chandler from Dallas, Texas, and I was just calling in response to the characters we wish we could be. And I knew if I thought about this too hard, I'd be up all night. But just first inclination, I had to go with a nostalgic pick, and I would probably have to be Peter Venkman from Ghostbusters. I loved that movie as a kid. Wanted to be a Ghostbuster, had all the toys, and for such a dangerous job, it seemed like it was always pretty fun. And he always usually ended up winning over the girl and winning over a whole city, especially a city like New York. So that's my take. Keep up the great job, guys. Thanks.
Yes, I totally agree. Dr. Peter Venkman, Bill Murray in Ghostbusters, absolutely. I've also got, quickly, Jerry Mulligan, Gene Kelly in American in Paris. Cool guy,
yeah.
From Jersey, probably. Sings
great
and dance
dancer.
With the best of them. Chili Palmer, John Travolta in Get
yeah.
Shorty. I've got Atticus Finch and Jefferson Smith. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, of course, and To Kill a Mockingbird. And Walter Burns, Cary Grant. I've got to be Cary Grant as well.
Okay.
His Girl Friday.
You feel better now that you got those in, Sam?
Wow. And Mary Poppins.
I can't right, believe I let you get away with that. Let's get to your number five then.
Okay, here's my exception to my criteria. Bob Dylan in Don't Look Back.
I thought about that. I swear to God, yes. I was putting my list together, and yep. I thought, I was thinking of the Counting Crows,
yeah.
And I want to be Bob Dylan. I was waiting for you to pull out that line.
Yes. And I have to say, like, part of it is, I started to think, like, there's got to be a rock star in the history of film that I'd want to be, because who doesn't want to be a rock star?
Yeah.
And yet, you think of it, all of the rock stars on film, depressed, drug-addled, idiotic, and there is no rock, you know, fictional rock star that exists. Bob Dylan will even go to greater heights than when we see him in Don't Look Back, but he's still got a sense of, he's certainly completely self-empowered. He's at the top of his game. He's loved by critics, by other musicians,
yeah.
by fans around the world, but he's still got that sense of innocence, that he's letting it all happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of you saw of Scorsese's recent documentary about Dylan, and
haven't
it's like
yet, yeah.
how he doesn't let Scorsese in at all, doesn't really open up about himself, and it just reminded me all the more of Don't Look Back, how just incredible.
So you, Sam, would like to be more aloof and cold and detached from the world?
Absolutely.
Okay, sounds
That's
great
me.
To me.
Come on, see, the way that he was received by that audience
sure.
in Britain.
Okay. So, okay.
Amazing.
It's a fine choice.
Shame Donovan.
Yeah.
In your face.
All right. Well, you had her in your extra 6 through 10 that
her?
You got. Yeah, you had Nora Charles.
Yes.
Well, I've got her husband.
Oh, yeah.
I've got Nick Charles in there as my number 5. Let's face it. He gets to drink all day without getting drunk.
That's right.
He's filthy rich.
Yep.
Ridiculously smart.
Yep.
He's tough, unflappable in any situation. He is sort of the ultimate guy's guy, even though he's a little bit poncy. Is that the right word?
I don't think
poncy.
So.
Yeah, it's a word. He's like snobbish and a little prudish. He's a little uppity. He's aristocratic. Poncy? Yeah, he's a ponce.
Hmm. Get that with your pillows.
I'm going to look that
wherever.
Up in Pella, Iowa. I'm going to look that up when we get off
Poncy
the air.
Poncy pillows.
Yeah, Poncy pillows. Anyway, so that right. is my number 5, Nick Charles.
All right, my number 4.
From The Thin Man, of
The
course.
Thin Man. My number 4 is Sheriff John T. Chance, of course.
Oh, man.
John Wayne, you forgot.
I did.
If it's going to be up to me to impose the law, there's no way I'm doing it without somehow taking on a John Wayne persona. And maybe he's a little proud, but he's loyal. He's never less than in charge. He's got Angie Dickinson clamoring after him. What's not to like? Again, maybe you're sequestered to the West turn of the century, not the most
uh-huh.
the best place to hang around, but you got Dean Martin singing you to sleep.
Ricky Nelson.
Ricky Nelson.
Yeah.
Come on.
Okay, it's a good choice. It
yeah,
really is.
It
my number 4, I'm going old school as well. My number 4, I've got a tie. Humphrey Bogart as both Philip Marlowe in The Big Sleep and Rick Blaine in Casablanca.
Sure.
Both of these characters, and I think you'll find this throughout with all of my choices. I think guys, we kind of aspire to this where they are never flustered.
Yeah.
They just never get too worked up and always seem to have the right thing to say. But in the case of Rick Blaine, of course, he's actually vulnerable. He actually does have some vulnerability, and actually that paradox just makes him even cooler. And Humphrey Bogart pulls that off completely. And in the case of Marlowe, his mind at work, the way he's always two steps ahead of everyone,
yeah.
and while being tough at the same time. Got to have Bogey on there. If you got to have John
but
Wayne, I got to have
Bogey.
But
cynical and jaded and heartbroken.
Sure.
Wants to live that life.
I don't know. If I got to be Humphrey
me.
Bogart, I would.
All right.
Okay.
I'm going to be Ferris Bueller in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Another olive branch to our 80s people
right.
who were offended.
I mean, I asked my brother this question, you know, who would you be if you could be one character? And you know, and I was like, you know, what people are saying, you know, think of the more adventurous characters,
right.
the Han Solos, XYZ.
Yeah.
And he was like, but those people are in danger.
True.
You know, these people have to risk their lives. And he was like, who who doesn't want to be Ferris Bueller? Gets away with everything.
Yeah.
Always has the right thing to say. Hot girlfriend. Gets to sing Twist and Shout, Coming Down Michigan Avenue.
Right.
Loved by everyone. I mean, I don't think there's anything
it's
not
a great
to like.
Choice. You're right, because he's loved by the stoners, dweebs, and everybody, right? They all love him. And
the only person that hates him is the high school principal.
Is the principal, Mr. Rooney.
Mr. Rooney.
So a great choice, really. Yeah. I can't believe I overlooked Ferris Bueller. My number three, speaking of characters in peril, apparently that's what I'm interested in. I'll give you a quote here. I've just seen so many sides of you, I want to make sure I know who I'm dealing with. I start fighting a war, I guarantee you'll see something new. He should have been my badass, my Tyler Durden winner of 2005,
right,
instead of Christian Bale. I'm actually putting on Malcolm Reynolds from Serenity.
Oh, yes.
Captain Malcolm Reynolds,
you're right.
Nathan Fillion. This was on just the other day on HBO.
Oh, wow.
I hadn't seen it since we saw it in the theater and reviewed it. And I liked it even more watching it again, watching just the way that the script, the humor of it, and the timing of everything is just so perfect.
Yeah.
And all the performances are good. The timing, again, is really what amazes me. And here's a case where Malcolm Reynolds is a guy who, obviously very smart, very clever, has hilarious things to say, usually great lines, but he's a leader. And he has to make tough decisions and yet still makes the decision. I mean, he always has to make a decision in a crucial moment where a lot of people might freeze. I think we would want to be the guy who would be able to make that decision, whether it's right or wrong. He has to do it. He's a badass and he's cool. I could see wanting to be. I mean, who doesn't want to be the captain of a starship?
Nobody. Not me. I mean, nobody doesn't want to be.
Exactly.
Yeah. Good pick. You had him as your number four, number five, I think. I've got Nick Charles on here. William Powell from The Thin Man. Married to Myrna Loy. Semi-retired, really, I think, in The Thin Man at the beginning.
Yeah, he is.
Beloved by everyone. Again, I mean, in many ways, a grown-up Ferris Bueller that knows how to mix the greatest martini in the world.
That's a great point. He is. He's a grown-up Ferris Bueller.
What's better than being, you know, a teenage Ferris Bueller, being the grown-up?
That's true. Getting to still act that way. And in my mention of him as my number five, I failed to mention, yes, of course, The Great Marriage and The Great Wife.
Great Wife, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, my number two, this everyone sees coming up Broadway. He's got cool in the title. It's Cool Hand Luke. He's the ultimate anti-hero. You can't say in some way he doesn't get broken by the end of the film, but what it takes to break him is far more than just about any man, certainly us, could take. He is Paul Newman. Yeah, I'd like to be Cool Hand Luke. I'd be really disturbed. I'd be incarcerated. All those things would happen, sure.
You'd take it.
At moments in your life, you can't tell me you wouldn't want to be as cool as Luke Jackson.
I'd rather be Indiana Jones,
okay,
which is my number one. I mean, I'd rather get away with it. I'd rather go after the Nazis, beat them, than, you know, be incarcerated in a swamp prison.
Okay.
The benefits of being an older brother. When you play pretend when you're a kid, you play Indiana Jones and your younger brother plays shortstop. Okay?
Short round.
And Leah Thompson played Short Round, if I recall correctly. I actually remember, I think it was like Thanksgiving Day. Ben and I had the day off. We live next to a trailer park, which I know gives a really idyllic vision of
New Hampshire,
but it's on a lake. The Lake House trailer park. Exactly. And we're playing Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. So at least I didn't make him play Kate Capshaw. We're playing
in these ditches too.
Or whatever. And all of a sudden, this truck comes blaring up to us.
Uh-huh.
We start running. This big blue truck is chasing us. We're running. How awesome is this? But the truck peels in front of us, and it's the dad of the guy that owns the trailer park. He thinks Ben and I, Indiana Jones and Short Round, are spying on his daughter.
Wow.
How I wish I had retained Indiana Jones's integrity, Harrison Ford's integrity. Instead, as I recall, there may have been tears. There may have been some tears.
Like a child. A little child.
Wild like a baby.
That's what you did.
I don't know if I even thought to tell the truth. We were playing Indiana Jones. Anyway, come on.
Nice story.
There's little I need to say here.
Okay.
I hope.
Well, actually, there is little because guess what? He's my number one, too.
Oh, thank God.
But tied with the other Harrison Ford character.
Han Solo.
I know it's obvious, but I would want to be those two characters.
Yep.
Han Solo is, as I've said before, the first character I ever wanted to be. Tough, says the right thing, gets the girl.
Yes.
Funny, all these guys, you know, you like them when they have
a bullwhip or a blaster.
Witticism at the right moment. And of course, Indiana Jones has the brawn and the brains.
Yes.
So,
professor of archaeology.
Yeah, I mean, coolest characters. What guy doesn't want to be? What guy like us didn't grow
any
up
kid,
impersonating them?
That's what I'm saying.
Trying our best. Okay, well, there we go.
There we go. That's our top five. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening this weekend, Robin Williams in Barry Levinson's Man of the Year Alex Rider Stormbreaker, The Grudge 2, and pro wrestler John Cena as The Marine. Next week, as we said, we're going to have the special Chicago Film Fest edition of our show talking about Dirt Nap, Come Early Morning, and a few other films. We'd like to thank the Arcade Fire and Merge Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at mergerecords.com.
Check out our Top 5 Archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. And also on the blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And driving Sam to the train in a hurry, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.